Bird Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Pompeii, Indian Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL, Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, right here on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and 100.7. We are also heard on the World Wide Web at WWBC. For our listeners who are tuning in today, my good friend Danny is running the board. Ellen Little will be with us in a minute or two. There was a lot of traffic today, and she's here. We sit here every Monday on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and we speak about things that are going on right here on in Brevard County, Florida. We speak about things that are going on, issues around our state and around our world. And I have to say that our show has become a place where everyone has a story to tell, from social issues to political issues, emotional issues, financial issues, environmental issues, whatever it is, we are here to learn. And for those of you who are just tuning in, you can also tune in live on WWBC.
Right, on 1510 WWBC.com. You can hit that listen live button, or you can listen to any of our archive shows. You can actually listen to them by date. And then if you go to SitaMediaInc.com, you can actually search and find all of your favorite shows. After 12 years, Sita, 52 weeks a year, we've got some fantastic people that we've showcased and that you've had an opportunity to meet, and friends that have become lifelong friends.
Yes.
It's just been an amazing journey with you. So thank you so much.
Thank you for showing up and being here for 12 years with me as well. And we have an action-packed show today.
Yes, we do.
So I read this book. You've got to help me pronounce it. And the author, Stephen Laurel, is calling in. He is a retired U.S. Army. Is it
so? Guanahani.
Guanahani, like iguana. Guanahani.
Sure, yeah.
Except no, I. Guanahani is written by a gentleman. His name is Dr. Stephen Laurel, and he's a retired U.S. Army officer. He's a professor, a sailboat captain, and an author. It's a novel of adventure and love set during the Columbus expedition to the New World in 1492. The main character, his name is Alonso. He sails on the Nina, which is one of the ships, and encounters Native American Taínos, on the exotic islands of the Caribbean, a tangled web of discovery, betrayal, cruelty, battles, disasters, hope, romance, and love. Its category is historical fiction, and it's the first of three books. But here's the thing. Everything he talked about in this book is happening in today's world.
That's so cool.
So I read it, and I think it took me 9 hours to read it. I got it from Amazon on Friday, and I started it on Saturday. And in between my lunches and this and that, I read it. So before we go to him, though,
And you're going to have to share, of course.
And our second guest our first guest is Dr. Stephen Laurel, and we'll go right with him in a minute. The second guest, we've had him before, is Lance Hilsinger. Mm-hmm. I think I sent you that email.
Yep.
And he's going to be he's talking the second segment. He's going to be calling in to speak about his memoir that he wrote, In Place of the Parent, Child Protective Services. And he's going to describe for us the child welfare system. But before we go to that, I have to say, you know, we're hearing about all the cuts that are going on in the state of Florida with Medicaid, mm-hmm. with the elderly. 20% is being cut from nursing home for care for the elderly. And then we're hearing about the banning of books for schools. And it's almost like we're going backwards a little bit. And it is very scary. I was just telling Danny, I wouldn't be surprised if later on somebody decided that we don't need museums. Right. Because it looks like people don't want to learn about history. And the more you learn about history, the more you understand and realize that the people that came before us shaped a path for us now. The past determines our present, and it will determine the future. Right. But it's what we learned from it.
right?
Exactly right. And that's why great books like the authors that we have coming on today kind of shed a little bit of light on what's going on. But also one of the other big messages that we've always had on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is get involved with your local politics. Make sure that you stay involved. Make sure you stay involved in your cities, in your municipalities. Find out what they're doing, especially with things like that. And in this case, this is our state. So we're all involved.
Right. Well, people need to stay involved and engaged and, you know, be part of the change you want to see. Most of us, you know, when we see underserved students, underserved areas, places where people dream about resources and opportunity, we want to be that mentor for them.
That's right.
And we only learn all of that because of history. And talking about history, you know, Trinidad and Tobago, where I was born and raised, was discovered by Christopher Columbus in 1498. And I have to tell you, when I read Mr. Stephen Laurel's book, all I could think about was, you know, when we were children, they didn't tell you enough about what happened to the Indians on the islands. The island was already inhabited. And we just learned, oh, Christopher Columbus discovered Trinidad and Tobago. It was named after the Holy Trinity in 1498. He found land that was inhabited by the Caribs and the Arawaks. And then we learned about the Europeans and we learned about the Spanish and whatever. But this book by Stephen Laurel, Guanahani, really took me back. So he's on the phone, and I welcome to our show, Dr. Stephen Laurel.
Well, Sita, it's an honor and a privilege to talk to you.
Oh, my gosh, you are amazing. I read the book. I got it on Friday evening, and I said, there's no way I'm going to be able to finish this book by Monday, but I did. And I love your characters. I love the settings. I like the way you kept the readers involved. It's almost like you took us back to San Salvador and Trinidad and the Leeward Islands and all the islands that Christopher Columbus discovered, and you made us feel like we were part of the book. But before we go into the book, I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about you, because your bio, you are a retired U.S. Army officer, you're a professor of philosophy. You taught at the University of Honolulu. You taught business and other things in Southern California. And you're also a sailboat captain and an author. So tell us a little bit more about yourself, because Ellen here has not heard about you as yet, and I want her to learn a little bit.
I know. I just read about you this morning. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I've been very fortunate. I've had multiple careers in my life, and I've been very lucky. Right out of high school, first of all, I was raised in Southern California in Los Angeles during the 1960s, and, you know, to a teenager, that was the center of the universe. But I joined the Army in 1971 and was stationed with Admiral McCain's senior staff, J-3 operations, during the Vietnam War. And in 1975, when the war was over, I enlisted into the infantry and was sent to Germany in a long-range reconnaissance platoon and was patrolling the Iron Curtain at that time. After that, in about the 1980s, I went to Warrant Officer Flight School and became a helicopter pilot and was sent back to Germany to fly Hueys, UH-1 helicopters, for the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. When I completed my tour there, I went back to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and was a night vision goggle instructor pilot there for, gosh, at least 5 years before being deployed to the first Gulf War with the 101st Airborne. And then the capstone of my career for the Army was I was running the night vision devices training and operations facility at Fort Rucker, and retired from the Army in 1993 and received the award of Best Instructor of the Year. And that was a real honor. Okay. After that, during my career in the Army, I was always going to night school. So I got a Bachelor of Science degree in Professional Aeronautics, an MBA, and a doctorate in education from Auburn University. So I was always busy doing two jobs, usually.
And in between that, you did get married, and you have children and grandchildren. And, I mean,
I do.
You're awesome.
It's do what you love, right?
Right.
Apparently, because you were doing all the things you love. So what inspired you to write the book Guanahani? Is that how you spell
Guanahani?
Guanahani?
Guanahani. That's correct.
Excellent.
Well, you know, everyone has a special book that they either they fell in love with while they were young or while when they were growing up. And my favorite book was Admiral of the Ocean's Sea, The Life of Christopher Columbus by Samuel Eliot Morison. He was not only a Harvard professor, but he was also an admiral. And that book captivated me so much that I decided that that was what I wanted to write about. And so during the time when I was teaching high school in California for 12 years, I was thinking about it. And also, I was teaching undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral students in the evening practical research statistics. And I'm still doing that online. But everybody has, they want to write a book. Some people, not everyone, but, and that was the book I wanted to write. And when I retired and moved to the Caribbean to the beautiful island of Puerto Rico.
That's where he lives, Ellen.
I opened up all of the Home Depots in Puerto Rico.
We need to go
all
there
nine
one
of
day.
Them. I spent a lot of time there. My Spanish is much worse now.
I bought my sailboat there in your neck of the woods there in Fort Lauderdale, and I sailed it through the Bahamas to Puerto Rico, and that's when I stopped at Guanahani. And that really solidified the ideas and my desire to write the book.
So there's actually an island called Guanahani?
It's San Salvador.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. Because oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh. You took us back to a place that is so lush and beautiful and green and natural and caves. And I learned so much from you in this book. And it's amazing that, you know, a lot of people dream of the golden years, right? But you're living it. You bought that boat. You went to Puerto Rico. It took you 10 years to write the book? Or was the idea there for 10 years?
The idea was there for 10 years. It took me 1 year to write the book because, you know, I the computer makes it easy. And my wife is a wonderful editor. And, you know, there are programs out there now that not only help you write the book, but they also help you publish it with Amazon Kindle and how to set up websites, things like that.
Yeah. And where did you find your characters? How did you develop the characters? Were there people that you met along the way or people you had in your head that you knew exactly how you were going to form these characters? Because this book is going to be made into a movie one day. And the main character, Alonzo, I've been trying to think, like, who would play him?
And don't to giggle at that, the movie being made, because here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, Sita's connected with all sorts of movie producers and documentary people.
Oh, God.
And
people
it's amazing
money.
What connections.
People need money.
That's right.
You know? Yeah, so how did you find your – how did you build the characters?
Well, the character is who I wanted to be. And not only that, but today – we have to understand that there are issues that are going on today, and they're the same issues that were happening in the past. Things like slavery, women's rights, inequality, racism, things like that. And I thought to myself, well, I don't want to talk about a main character like Christopher Columbus. I want a simple sailor that was sailing on the Niña as one of the crew, and it would be from his point of view. And then everything else was just from my experience.
Yeah, and you know, as I read the book, I kept remembering there's an Indian sage that had said that there were three all-powerful evils, and it were the three were lust, anger, and greed. And mm-hmm. I keep coming back to that because in your book, the theme, I mean, I think it was page 142, where Alonzo was having a discussion with Oroco and Baguia, I think, and they were talking, mm-hmm. and he said that the Spanish people in the book, you know, Christopher Columbus, that would be, and his men, they talk peace, but they lie, he says. They will take everything, your gods, your gold, your woman, and your land. And I thought, oh, my God, that resonates in today's world with war and what happens with life, you know?
Yeah, the vices of the past have not changed. And that's what's polarizing. And it's also the dichotomy of some of the issues that we have today. Mm-hmm. There are those that say, you know, we can't be responsible for what happened in the past. honest, and we shouldn't be. But then again, there are those that say, and both positions are understandable, is that we should acknowledge what happened in the past, good and bad, and make sure that it doesn't happen again, as far as, you know, war and greed. But the Spanish had actually they had conquered the Canary Islands before Columbus got to the New World. They already had a program. They knew what they were doing. They would go in and defeat the local natives because they had guns, germs, and steel, and then they would take everything that they had.
Yeah, because in the book, you know, they were stopping in certain islands to refurnish their supplies, and I kept thinking, well, it couldn't be that Christopher Columbus is the first one to get there, because there were already ports and there were already blacksmiths and saloons and places for them to get wine and women and food, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm like, well, somebody was there before Christopher Columbus and they had already established some sort of a order in their life over there.
Infrastructure.
Oh, yeah, the Canaries had been occupied by the Spanish for 100 years before 1492.
Yeah, and, amazing. You know, your character, Alonso, talk about a guy who was observant, because he had witnessed something that happened to a woman in his village, and that formed his opinion about why the men should not be taking advantage of the woman and, you know, basically assaulting them sexually and whatever. And he took that with him on all of his journeys, and he actually became a protector of women. So when you say the main themes of the novel is not only exploration and adventure, but it is about women's rights, and it is about equality, and it is about racism, because Alonso saw that, and he tried his best to show us that he was not going to be one of those people.
Absolutely. His character is stellar in that because of his experiences with the Inquisition and with what was going on in Spain during that time, he decided, of course, to make himself a better person by not embracing those ideas. And he really didn't care about gold or anything like that. He was looking for more universal principles of justice and love and things like that.
Right. And so when you were writing the book, when did you find you had most of the time to write? Was it in the morning? Or the evening, were the memories overpowering you from your actual voyages? Where did you find the time to write?
Well, I usually write at night from, 9 o'clock until midnight or so, when I'm by myself in the computer room and I can collect all my thoughts. But I had collected probably 24 research books. And the internet nowadays makes everything easy. You can Google any subject that you want, be it, you know, lobsters to what kind of anchors they use. So information is out there. All you have to do is put it together. And I recommend everybody should write a book. You know, it's never been an easier time to do it now.
Right. And everybody has a story to tell, right? Everyone I know has a story to tell. So, for our listeners who tune in, and we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Lauro. We're talking about his book, Guanahani. It's a great book. I read it in 8 hours, and I absolutely loved it. I just want to go to that island and swing in a hammock.
and I didn't get a chance to read the book as quickly as Sita did, but I just love the vision and the creative writing that you put into it. I know it's about, you know, obviously I could tell that it was about a story, just a little bit that I've gotten into it, like the Christopher Columbus story, for instance. But the vision and the extra stuff that you put in it, have you always been creative in your writing skills and the things that you've done in the past?
Actually, no. My background is in technical writing.
See, that's what I'm saying. Like, this doesn't compute for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Where'd you get the other side of your brain working?
Because he's retired. He's having fun.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. So, Dr. Lauro, what does literary success look like to you? Because, like, people write a book, right? And they say, oh, God, I can't market the book. But to me, your book is already successful because it's changed my mind, and I'm going to recommend it to other people. And I think by me recommending the book and all of us looking at what happened in the 1400s and discovering of land and Arawaks and Caribs and how people took it over. I think you've made a difference already, but what does the literary success look like to you?
Well, it's actually my first book other than, you know, technical dissertations and handbooks. So I'm not really, if you're an author and you're out to make a fortune, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah. Yes.
It's more, you know, nobody can, not everybody's Stephen King. So, you know, it's mostly the satisfaction that I'm putting down my thoughts for posterity, and that it's self-satisfaction and self-esteem. So you got to look at it that way. And it is available, though, on Amazon, Kindle, and paperback. And there's a website, guanahaninovel.com. And there's a Facebook page for authors that I have called Guanahani on Facebook. So, yeah.
So, Alonzo, when
I encourage you to buy it.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. I'm going to. I already told a couple of people, and they were going to buy it this, I think yesterday, two ladies were going to look at it. So when Alonzo returned and he met up with Guanahani, and they had the, and of course, she's having a baby. In the end of the book, you talk about Christopher Columbus had made it back to Spain, and his brother, who had broken away from being with the ships, he was also one that went back to Spain. So you are alluding to the fact that there's going to be the book two and the book three and the book four. And is it already in the works?
It is. Wow. In fact, the next novel will be out in October, and it will deal with the return of the Spanish and the Spanish attempt at conquest. And that will be the second, third, and fourth voyage of Columbus. And the novel after that will be the Spanish Caribe War. It's a misconception that the Spanish walked all over the Native Americans, and it wasn't that easy. They put it, the Taínos, the indigenous Native Americans, put up a heck of a fight and had many victories. So that's going to be the third novel, and the fourth one will actually deal with the original Pirates of the Caribbean, which were the Native Americans, the Caribs. Long before the Blackbeard and Captain Morgan and those
and
were
Johnny
in the 1700s.
Depp.
And Johnny Depp, Alan said. But, you know, I woke up this morning and my husband was out in the yard tending to his beautiful roses. And I went there and I said, you know, Dr. Stephen Laura told us in the book how to make gunpowder. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, listen, do you know how to make gunpowder? And he said, what? And so I told him about the Batcave and the salt and the sulf. And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, yeah. Those are things you learn in science. And but the way you explain it in the book and the way the woman had to help so that Alonzo will make this gunpowder for the Taínos, it was amazing. I mean, everyone should read this book. I highly recommend Guanahani. So tell our listeners a little bit. Now, you're also... you're a philosopher. You studied undergraduate in philosophy. Why did you settle on the Spaniards and Christopher Columbus and the Taínos, this region of the world versus another region of the world?
Well, I'm living in the Caribbean. I've been here for 10 years and right. I've sailed all over. So that is of interest to me. As soon as I finish these a series of books on Guanahani, my next interest is the Incas and the Inca Empire with Pachacuti and the whole Inca Empire, and getting down to how the natives actually lived before the Spanish got there. That's anthropologically of interest to me.
Well, you know, I went to Costa Rica for a wedding, right? And I was saying to my husband, I had the best time of my life. Although I was born in Trinidad and Tobago, I never really enjoyed the island because I left when I was 19, then I had a family and whatever. But I was saying to my husband when we went there, the yuca, you know, the yam, the plantains, mm-hmm. the fresh eggs, all of that is still there. It's part of the resort feeling. And each guest had a hammock and a hut. And your book took me back to Costa Rica when I was there. And I was like, wait a minute. the Indians left the footprint for us in to survive. So your book is actually, it's about survival. These people survived until we came and introduced the weapons of war and the germs and everything else.
That's correct. I agree. They had mastered nature to a point that Europe long ago had already devastated. And they were more in tune with their environment, whereas the Spaniards, when they arrived, they just wanted to exploit it. And one case in point is if you go to any of the islands in the Caribbean today, there are no trees because they were all cut down by the Spaniards and made into ships and shipped back home. So, you know, it was all about exploitation. And in the world today, even now, that's going on.
Yes, we all see what's happening with the Amazon, with the rainforests, and we hurt for it. But your book, I think I would love to see this book in every school in America, in maybe high school, because right now we've got this thing here where they don't want certain books in schools and, you know, they're banning books and all that. But your book actually gives us a way to live, because you talk a lot about the compassion and the empathy and, you know, how the Taínos, they befriended the Spanish, and there was a lot of trust and mutual respect. There was a good handshake, which we don't see anymore. I mean, how do we get that into today's world when we see so much inequality and racism and hate and fear and disrespect for fellow human beings? How do we get that good old-fashioned handshake back, Dr. Laura?
I'm an unrealistic optimist, and I would like to believe that there are universal principles for which all civilization should aspire to. And it is necessary that we recognize what those characteristics are, and that we should educate people about those principles so that we can not only make the world a better place, but we can alleviate some of the transgressions that we had in the past and look forward to a much better future for our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, and Dr. Laura, we have about two more minutes, and so I wanted to ask you really quick, what are the ethics of writing about historical figures?
Well, it is historical fiction, so you have some leeway, like I did with the characters. Alonso probably didn't really exist on the voyage there, but there were characters that were similar to him. So it's the ethical thing there is that you should be as accurate as possible to the historical situation, but you should express your own individual freedom of what you believe in and inject it into your characters and to the surrounding occurrences.
Yeah.
That's my advice.
Right. And it makes a lot of sense, because all the islands were named after the Spanish, like Trinidad and Tobago, El Salvador, Puerto Rico. Now, and you know, mm-hmm. Your book puts a lot into perspective, because I was saying to Danny, our producer, that when we were children, they didn't really go in depth as to what Christopher Columbus did, the Caribs and the Arawaks. You know, all they taught us was the Caribs were fierce and the Arawaks were tame, and the Spanish came and, you know, they gave each other, traded, bartered and whatever. And we learned, but we didn't really go in depth. And your book is actually quite educational. I absolutely loved it. So tell our listeners, Dr. Laura, where can our listeners find your book to buy, and tell us when we're going to get the second one?
Well, you can get it go to Amazon. And just type in Guanahani, and the Kindle version will pop up, and the paperback. I think I will probably put a hardback version out. And then the next book will be out in October, and then I'll start to work on the third one and hope that we can get that out also within 6 months or so. So by the middle of next year, the third thing, it's modern, of course, you know. You can drink the water, and we have the U.S. government, in the post office, FBI, we have all that. We're a U.S. territory,
right.
So it's safe. But it's lush and beautiful, the beaches, the rainforest. You should come visit.
I will.
I loved my time.
Oh, this book, Ellen, I can't say enough about it. We'll put a picture of the book on our Facebook page. We will tell our listeners about it. And I hope and pray that more people take an interest in it, because you have given us quite an education about the Caribbean, the people that came before us. And you know what? They left, like I said, when I read the book, most of the food that they ate, we're still eating today. And the people didn't worry, but they didn't have obesity. They didn't have a lot of the diseases we have. They were slim. They were trim. And everyone worked. Everyone contributed to what they had to do in order to survive.
Absolutely.
What an amazing time getting to know you today. Thank you so much for calling in. We're going to make sure that all of this information is on our Facebook page as well as our website, cedamediainc.com. But we're going to listen to our sponsors real quick, and we'll be right back after these messages with Viewpoint with Ceda and Friends.
Fast. MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 13 locations, including one in Volusia County. With so many MedFast Urgent Care centers, there is a MedFast near you. MedFast offers top quality care that is close by, and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral, and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Ceda Begee on Viewpoint with Ceda and Friends. We had a robust first segment with Dr. Stephen Laura, who called in all the way from Puerto Rico, possibly part of the U.S. territories.
Mm-hmm. And talked about his great book, Guanahani.
And he talked, and also, you know, we forget that island does have more security than most of the Caribbean islands because it's part of the United States.
Absolutely.
And I have to remind people all the time that, yes, we may complain about the United States, but we do have it better than most countries.
Yes, we
trust
do.
Me, that I
for
know.
Sure, for sure.
So our listeners, or for our listeners who are tuning in, we can be heard on FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and we're also heard on AM 1510. We got to do our station justice by giving out our call letters, WWBC.
That's right.
Because people are tuning in all over in their cars, on the web.
That's right. And they can listen live by just going to 1510wwbc.com. You hit that listen live button. You'll get us live just as we're talking right on the air. And then if you miss the show for whatever reason, you can certainly go back to all of our archives on 1510wwbc.com and also on our website, Viewpoint with Ceda and Friends, which is under cedamediainc.com.
Right. And our first segment was with Dr. Stephen Laura, who everybody should read that book and learn about the Caribbean and Christopher Columbus and the discovery of everything, right? So the second segment is with Lance Hilsinger. What a lovely name. I could say that with no trouble. And he's the author of two books. Lance was a child welfare social worker in California for almost 34 years. His first book, The Place of a Parent Inside Child Protective Services is a memoir and that describes the child welfare juvenile court system. And his second book is called Build a Better Bridge. It's a social policy for the 21st century. And, you know, as I was preparing for this book, I try to think about the mistakes I made parenting or my parents made parenting. And there were plenty. Mm-hmm. Being a parent doesn't come with a handbook.
No.
Giving birth doesn't come with a handbook. And I could think of my Indian parents who had very high expectations for their children and for us to have a career. But did we always have the resources? No. How did we make it by the grace of God? Through mentors and a village.
That's right.
And in America, that village is one of the people in that village is Lance Hilsinger.
Mm-hmm.
That saw that people needed assistance and he jumped to it. So Lance, thanks for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
You're most welcome. So, and if I might start, I'd like to talk about a topic today about housing, which I know is a big issue in Florida.
Oh my gosh. You have no idea what we're seeing here in Florida. The housing prices has jumped triple the prices, and they're building and building and building. And there is nowhere to drive. Now our roads are crowded, infrastructure problem, septic tank problems. And it comes down, of course, to money, money, money. Who is going to be profiting off these properties? And they're still, we still don't have enough houses for the homeless and people who need it. So, yes, talk about the housing situation.
Well, what I'd like to do is just simplify it. Imagine an America that had 100 households. And there are 50 households that are homeowners and 50 households that are renters. And every household has $10,000 in savings. I know a lot of people don't have that nearly that much, and a lot of people have more, but just for simplicity, let's say everybody has $10,000 in savings, but the homeowners have $10,000 in equity.
Yes.
In that 100-household America, the homeowners have two-thirds of the wealth. If you go out 9 years and the homes appreciate by $10,000 for 9 years each year.
These homes and, you know, the future of it, of people being able to afford it, it's starting to seem a little less opportunistic.
Less likely.
Yeah, yeah. That people are going to be able to do that. And you've worked in social services for over 30 years. So you've seen this huge gap between the social service system, you know, much like what we help and provide, and the private sector. So the private sector is really starting to buy some things up. So maybe talk a little bit about that as well, about your thoughts about that.
Well, I think that one of the things of my book, Build a Better Bridge, is talk about incentives, financial incentives, and or disincentives. And one way we could do is just say, hey, if you're buying an owner, non-owner occupied, in other words, if you're an investor, let's say you have to pay a 5% surcharge. And that money could be used to provide, you know, subsidized housing or public housing. And just say, because we want to encourage people to have homeowners, to be live in neighborhoods. Any landlord will tell you that people who own their own homes take better care of them. But it's also not just that, about it makes a better society when people own their own homes.
Yeah, when you have skin in the game, right? When you pay taxes.
Right, when you pay taxes, when you're...
Yeah. Right. And so, but, you know, you hit on a great point, because I, you know, sometimes I think about when I was a kid and my dad would say, save your money and buy a piece of land. And back then we were like, these people are so interested in land. He didn't care if the land was near a cemetery. He didn't care if it was near, you know, a ravine, wherever it was. But they believed that if you had that land, you could put up a little house. And you could build it room by room, but it is your home, it is your land, and you own it. And I think that's what you're saying, is people just want to own something. And I think in America, too, here in the United States, sometimes you got to start small. You dream big, but you start small. So people should be able to go into distressed neighborhoods. And even if they don't like that neighborhood, buy a home. That's your yard. That's your home. You're going to pay taxes and you're going to have skin in the game to try to improve that neighborhood. What do you think?
I think also that, but one of the other points I want to make is that eventually all of us will die. And for instance, my grandparents were renters when they died. There was nothing for my mother to inherit. But If my children don't get a house, there's nothing for the grandchildren to inherit. And so home ownership, not just as a sense of land, sense of community, it also creates a more socially economic balance. And that empowers the next generation, to the succeeding generations, to have wealth. And that's why I think that we need to encourage home ownership and discourage corporate home ownership. One, like I said, with a, like I say, a 5% tax on non-owner-occupied homes, but also create sort of a similar program to the GI Bill of Rights. There are many people who want to serve their country, but for whatever reason they don't want to serve in the military. Have some sort of program where if you work so many volunteer hours, you can, you know, the government will help you with the down payment, and then you continue so many hours. And so have the have that kind of program in there. And I talk a little bit more about the details of such a program in my book.
Well, that's sort of the premise of Habitat for Humanity a little bit too, right?
Right.
Well, yeah.
I think what you're saying is like you break the cycle of homelessness and you also break the cycle of poverty when you own that home to pass it on to your children or grandchildren. But here's the thing. These are things, too, that we all have to learn as children because, you know, people get an application for a credit card in the mail before they turn 16 or 17. And so kids come out of high school or college in debt with college debt and credit card debt. How about if we all just decided to start teaching the kids about home ownership and, you know, building equity? Because I think that's the problem. A lot of them are not educated by their parents or mentors because their parents are not educated themselves.
Well, I think that there's a, you're quite right. I think that at my kids are in their 20s, and I look back when I was 20, I certainly understood the business world, interest rates, equity, more than they do. Yes, I think that, that there's a lot of ignorance out there. There's also sort of a pecking order thing. If the current generation can't buy a house and re-rent at maybe very high rate, then somebody else down there, they have to rent someplace. That puts so much pressure on the marketplace that at the people who make very, very modest livings, who are, you know, hardworking Americans but don't have a lot, their job, particular job, doesn't pay very well, they can't afford to live anywhere. Or they live on the very wrong side of the railroad tracks, which does not, that that's not good for society either.
Yes.
Well, one of the things we have here in California, prices are in San Luis Obispo, where I am, and nearby Santa Barbara are also very, very expensive. And one of the concerns we have down in Santa Barbara is there's really only one highway that leads you in and out of Santa Barbara. So if that highway is, you know, if there's a mudslide or something, whatever, an accident that people can't get into in or out of Santa Barbara, is the police officers, firefighters, teachers, they can't afford to live in that in the in Santa Barbara because it's $1 million home. And one of the other ideas have is that we have shared equity. We had a situation out here where they hired a new superintendent of schools, and the school district gave them kind of a sweetheart deal. Okay, here, we'll help you with your buying your home. Because even for a superintendent of schools, home prices were pretty high. And that's, if that was good for teachers, police officers, firefighters, I'd be all for it. For one individual, I'm not for it. And that's where we have, because we need to have our the middle class jobs that are like teachers, firefighters, police officers, those kinds of jobs, be able to afford housing. And it's a very sad thing. As you talk about, part of it is supply and demand. The war on poverty started in the 1960s. And in 1965, there was about just under 6 million people in Florida. Today, there's 22 million people. But one thing that's reality is Florida is still 64,000 square miles. Florida hasn't grown, but the population has quadrupled.
Yeah, I mean, it is a sad day in the United States when a teacher can't afford to live in her district that she's teaching in. It's a sad day when a police officer can't afford to buy a home in the district, you know, where he's policing or superintendent. It's
yeah.
It's a sad day when, I mean, and but how did this happen? I mean, like you say, at one point in time, all of us who are living on the planet right now is we're going to be gone, right? So how do we, how can we change this, Mr. Lance, Hilsinger and leave a better footprint, because we're watching here where roughly 80% of the families on welfare, a father is not in the home. Under the Welfare to Work program, the mother is required to work a specific number of hours. Who's watching the children? And when you're paying for someone to watch your children, how are you accumulating that money to pay your rent? And then where can you live with the money that you earn as a single mom? Even if the father pays some money into it, that money is not going to the child. How do we fix it? Because we've got so many people that say they're pro-life and they're pro, but they're not really pro-child or pro-family. How do we get more people to care about the child and the family and where they live and how they live?
I think you made a good transition there, because so many of the, I dealt with mostly poor people. The vast majority of kids who enter foster care come from poor families, and their fathers were often incarcerated or working at marginal jobs. And you're right, they were very rarely not in the home with the mother. The two-parent family has an advantage just in child rearing, and it has an advantage economics. If you're trying to, if two people with modest paying jobs, the dad's out of the home, the mom's out of the home, and she's got the kids, there's very little, you know, disposable income after the end of the day, because you're paying two rents. You're paying, and that's the biggest expense. And so with respect to welfare, one of the things that we can do is that we need to encourage those dads to have legitimate work. Because if the children are on welfare, the dad's out of the home, whatever he makes and he's at his marginal job, stereotypically the marginal job, because if he had a really good job, he'd be paying regular just child support. That money goes not to the children, it goes to the taxpayer. And so the father doesn't have any incentive to work very much for his kids.
Yes. I agree with you 100%. You know, I was raised in a time where if you didn't work, you didn't eat. And it should be one step further. If you have teenagers at home, they should be doing something as well. I mean, I remember having to dig yam when I got home from school. I remember having to help
chores.
My father paint our home. I remember doing chores to help the household. But somewhere along the line, we got to a point where people are at home and collecting money. And that's okay if you need it and you have to get food, yes. But I think you hit on a good point that the father has to be held responsible for his children. And the mothers too. The government is here to help, but ultimately it is our responsibility to help feed, clothe, and take care of the children we bring into this world.
Well, and you talk about, you know, people or men specifically that live on the fringe of mainstream society, I think is what you called it, how they often turn to crime. Like, and I remember like silly movies like Fun with Dick and Jane, if you remember that, an entire city collapsed and men that you wouldn't normally see that would turn to crime started getting desperate, and that's what they chose to do. So, you know, your statistics about men and women, the gender equality between, you know, people even that are incarcerated and people that turn into crime, you know, nobody decides one morning that they're going to do it. There's a desperation attempt at some point for some of these people. It's not just necessarily a life that they lived before.
Right. And the incarcerated and the homeless are much less educated. When you look at the national average.
Which causes the desperation, right? Because they're not logically or maybe intellectually prepared for what they need to do in order to get themselves out of poverty.
Right. So talk a little bit with our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, Lance Hilsinger, about a different look at gender inequality and how that applies to homelessness and what's happening with the lack of having parents in a home.
Well, let's go back just very briefly to the incarceration. For each woman that's incarcerated, there's about 10. It's a little bit, it depends on whether you're talking about prison or jail, but roughly speaking, it's 10 men for every woman in jail. And the people who are incarcerated, whether it's a local jail or a state prison or federal prison, on average are not as well educated because they couldn't make a regular, you know, they couldn't make an honest living. Now, let's use the old-fashioned language. They just couldn't make an honest living. And if people who are desperate, yes, they will be angry at the world. They might get a little more inclined to be violent. they're more inclined to drown their sorrows, their frustrations in alcohol or drugs. So it's a very sad cycle that can build up, and recovering from that is terribly expensive for the government. I had one case where the father, you know, he got involved with drugs, and getting him back and his wife, he was one of the few married couples that I had in my counseling, getting him back on track was a very expensive process. They eventually succeeded. It was tens of thousands of dollars between foster care costs, the cost of attorneys, the court costs, if you add it all up. And the thing will be to prevent it, you know, and teach guys to have trades or, you know, and help boys graduate from school. The dropout rate for boys is much higher than it is for girls. That's an under-reported statistic there. When I served on the Student School Attendance Review Board, most of the time, it was a boy who was having problems, was having truancy problems. We'd have an occasional girl, but it was boys. And the way that, and I talk a little bit about this in my book, is that the way people we teach is not really boy-centered. Literature, English classes are all about literature. And that's not what we really need in a while. We need people who can write reports, whether that means a police officer writing a report or a supervisor writing a report of an accident at work, or a salesperson writing their sales presentation. That we need nonfiction writing. But what we do in our school system, we teach kids about, largely, about fiction writing, about fiction.
Yeah, so what you're saying is real world. I mean, we need more kids riding in the cars with the police and learning how to write the report before they actually become a police officer, like interns. You know, it used to be you took a guy, a kid to work, and they became interns, and they learned a trade, or they learned from older people how to write, how to weld, how to build. And we're lacking that right now.
And I think you write, I talk about welders in specific in my book because, you know, a community can only support so many welders. Welding is a very specific occupation. A county or a given area needs them or they don't. But when you, under the welfare and work rules, you can only get an exception from welfare for 1 year of college or 1 year of training. And that's fine if you land a job that corresponds to that thing. But if you take a year to become a welder and there's no welding jobs, it's a waste of government money and it leads to frustration. We need to encourage those welfare rules to say, let's get somebody who can really have an occupation and something that's going to lead to economic self-sufficiency, not just, you know, a ferry service, you know, as opposed to building a genuine bridge. That's why I use the metaphor of a bridge in the book.
Well, and we've said that a bunch here on the show, too, is that we really are big proponents of, if you're not ready for college, go to trade school. Like, and let's have that availability. I remember being in high school. We had FFA, you know, Future Farmers of America. Right. We had mechanics, school programs and
do
stuff
something.
Like that, that it was like they would do curriculum during the morning and then in the afternoon. Again, the children that chose that, or the adults, young adults, I should say, that chose that, they had an opportunity to learn a trade before they even got out of high school. And I remember going to journeyman plumber and journeyman electrician classes when I was a junior in high school because I wasn't sure if college was for me.
Well, in Germany, it's my understanding that even if you're on the college path, even if you're planning to be a doctor or a lawyer, you're required to take some vocational training along the way so that you appreciate the value of the work and so that you don't look, basically you're not snobbish about things.
Right. But you're never without a job, though. I mean, really. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, if you're a plumber, an electrician, or somebody that can work with their hands, mechanic, you can do anything.
So, Mr. Hilsinger, we have only 3 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you really quick, how can we increase the number of boys in trade and college? Because we're watching on the other end of the spectrum where women are now the decided majority in medical school, law school, veterinarian school, graduate school. And for each African-American man that's a psychologist, there's nearly a 6 or 7 African-American female psychologist. You have 2 minutes to let our listeners know how can we help more men to get involved in education and trade. So go for it.
Well, I think one of the things I've already talked about is change the curriculum in the high school. Make it more of a focus on nonfiction English classes, at least 1 year of nonfiction. The other thing is I also think you need to, you know, there's a, if you can see her, be her thing that like Dove Soap is doing right now, that's good for women, but there's not any kind of comparable for boys to be, aspire. You know, if you see a lot of ads for like Cuesta College, which is a local community college, and most of the ads for a while, they're only for girls going to, or young women going to school. I've seen a change. I think they're starting to recognize that, that the ads and the things that are promoting are starting to say, hey, we need to get men back in college. So we need them in men becoming doctors. You know, we need men to become psychologists because there's all this talk about mental health treatment. And men are reluctant to talk to mental health professionals anyways, and they're going to be much more reluctant in general to talk to a woman than a man. And so, if we want to make society mentally healthier, we need to have a better gender balance and mental health amongst other areas.
Right. And so we just want our listeners to know we're speaking with Mr. Lance Hilsinger. He's the author of two books. His first book, In the Place of a Parent, Inside Child Protective Services. The second book is called Build a Better Bridge, Social Policy for the 21st Century. And really quick, we have 30 seconds left. Where can we find a book and where can people buy it?
It's available on Amazon and as ebook or as hardbound. The In Place of a Parent is available on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all the major sites. I'm working on a third book that had an inspiration, by the way, from the History of Diving Museum in Key West. And so my third book is about interesting women of yesteryear. And so I got the inspiration of book why, and I hope to be your guest again because it has a connection to Florida where I got inspiration for that.
We would love that.
Well, we love speaking with you, and you do care about Americans and you do care about people creating wealth. And I think we appreciate you for trying to get people off social programs, even though we need them, and to start thinking about skin in the game. That should be the name of your book. Get some skin in the game. Create that wealth. Leave something behind for the next generation. Even if it's 10 feet by 10 feet, it's yours.
Exactly right. Exactly right. What an inspirational conversation today.
Thank you
so much for calling in. And tune in each and every week here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends here, 1 o'clock Eastern Time on AM 1510 WWBC, 94.7 FM, 99.9 FM, and 100.7 FM right here in Brevard County. And once again, Sita, fantastic show. Thank you so much to our guests. Thank you so much to the people that support the show and all of our sponsors. And we will see you next week here at 1 o'clock.
That's right. Right.